From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Confirmation hearings continue this week for President-elect Trump's cabinet nominees. And later today, it's his pick for Secretary of Education's turn. That would be Betsy DeVos, a billionaire Republican fundraiser and education lobbyist who is a proponent of voucher programs and charter schools. DeVos's nomination is controversial, and one of her chief critics is Randy Weingarten, who is the president of the American Federation of Teachers. She joins us now. And Randy Weingarten, what are your concerns about Betsy DeVos as Secretary of Education?
So she has actually been involved in education and in politics for 30 years in Michigan and has quite a record. She's never actually been engaged in public schools. It's not simply that she wasn't a teacher or a board member, didn't bring her kids to public schools, didn't go to public schools. She has had quite the antipathy towards public schools, particularly public schools where the most vulnerable children go. That's why I've called her the most ideological anti-public school nominee since the position was created by Carter decades ago. So if you look at the Michigan record, she and her husband are billionaires from two very, very rich families. You know, that's their right. But they are very fixated on the market can cure everything. The market, the free market, capitalism can do everything. And what that can't do, Christianity can do.
But are you saying that if she becomes Secretary of Education, that you're worried that she is going to make our public schools around the country more religious than they are at the moment?
What she has done is she has defunded, destabilized, and undermined public education in Michigan at every turn, and has pushed hard and has gotten the policies in Michigan that she envisioned to have unaccountable for-profit charter schools. And at the same time, the things that she has said that she wanted to do, that she thinks are good, meaning choice for children, those schools have been terrible. That's why Michigan is called the wild, wild west of charters. And frankly, the charters are worse than the publics. And what has happened since 2003 is that Michigan has tumbled in terms of public education from being in the middle of the states in 2003 in math and reading to now to the bottom to 41 and 42 in states in terms of fourth grade math and reading. So what I'm saying is that if you look at her record, that it hasn't helped either public school students whose monies have been drained from those schools, and it hasn't helped the people in the private alternatives who haven't gotten a good education either.
So do you think that that is a Michigan-specific issue, that charters were just not run well in Michigan, and that in other places – I mean, we talked yesterday about what's happened in New Orleans post-Hurricane Katrina, where they've gone very heavily in favor of charter schools and test scores have gone up there. Do you think that charter schools can ever work, or
– Yes. Yes,
it's just of you're course, saying the experience in Michigan was not effective.
But the reason that the experience in Michigan was not effective, and that's why even the charter school operators in Massachusetts have come out against her, is because she believes in making money off of public education. She believes in privatization. She believes in ignoring the church-state separation. She believes in shielding these schools from accountability. And that is what has made them fail.
So I imagine if Betsy DeVos were listening to this interview, she would say, oh, well, of course, the teachers' unions, they're so powerful. They don't want to hear about change in education reform and charter schools and vouchers because it hurts their power. What would you say back to that?
You know, first off, it is so ridiculous to actually say that the people who represent teachers don't want to change, because there's no one more than a teacher or a parent who wants to make sure that kids do well. And frankly, what you should be doing is we should be focusing on the well-being of children. Public schools have to be a viable choice. And at the end of the day, anyone who wants to be the Secretary of Education has to have a real investment and commitment in public schools, not be totally disconnected to them. Public schools can work for kids. Half the kids in America are poor. It is the one thing we give kids as an anchor of democracy, as a ladder of opportunity. I'm not saying that there shouldn't be other alternatives or things like that, but the public dollar has to go to make public schools viable choices for parents.
What's the one question you would like to be asked at her confirmation hearing today?
I would ask, why the antipathy towards public schools? Why call public schools a dead end? Why say that public schools should be retired? Why the antipathy towards LGBTQ students? Why the antipathy towards civil rights rules? Why the antipathy towards public education such that parent groups throughout the country have opposed your nomination? Those are the questions that I would ask her.
So after hearing you say that, do you think you're going to be able to work with her if she becomes education secretary?
Look, obviously, Jeremy, we will work with anybody we have to work with to help children have a chance at success.
That's Randy Weingarten, who is the president of the American Federation of Teachers. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Well, Congressman Ryan Zinke is President-elect Trump's nominee to head up the Department of the Interior, and his confirmation hearings are also today. The Republican has said he supports keeping land under federal protection, but a new administration means some change may be in the future. Emily Schwing from the Northwest News Network has more from Washington State.
President-elect Donald Trump may not be keen on the idea to hand federal land over to states. At least, that's what he told Field & Stream magazine a year ago. He said something similar last spring to the editor of Peterson's Hunting magazine prior to his nomination as the GOP's presidential candidate.
Our land is not in the condition that it used to be, so we'll put it back into condition, but we're not looking to sell off land.
Trump recently nominated Montana Representative Ryan Zinke to head up the Interior Department, the nation's federal land management agency. Zinke's been outspoken about his opposition to a change in ownership, but on their first day in office, members of the 115th Congress voted in favor of a rule change that would make land transfers easier, and Zinke was one of them. Last January, a group of out-of-state occupiers used heavy machinery to remove fencing at Oregon's Malheur National Wildlife Refuge. Their efforts to reclaim federal land as their own turned into a 41-day standoff, and a handful of local lawmakers also got on board. But in other rural parts of the Northwest, people who make a living off the land, ranchers, farmers, miners, and loggers, are only looking for more access and better management of federal land.
That's a whole other story.
It's 6 a.m. at the Crossroads Cafe, aptly named for its location at a fork in the road where two Washington State highways merge just south of two tiny sleepy towns, Usk and Cusick. This is where a handful of locals gather every morning. They say they only come for the coffee, but they linger for a few hours to talk about politics and reminisce about the days when this region boomed with industrial jobs and active sawmills, a time Lloyd Hastings says he felt the most free. But now,
if you're going to have a permit to carry a gold pan on federal land, how silly. Who come up with that?
What I hear you saying is, if it's deemed public land, so it's held in trust for public use, then the public should be allowed to do with it and on it what they want to do.
They definitely should have a say on it, but they aren't being asked anything. It's just everything that's happening is being poked down their necks.
Forests here in the Northwest are in desperate need of thinning, and they are extremely prone to wildfire. Hastings says perhaps a large fire might offer a more immediate solution in comparison to the red tape and bureaucracy he says plagues land management.
It's been mismanaged so badly for so many years that it's going to take a lot of natural occurrences for it to ever get back the way it ought to be.
Opinions differ among the Crossroads Cafe group, but nearly all of them agree. Tight budgets have much to do with what they see as mismanagement and declining forest health. In an October interview, Washington's outgoing public lands commissioner, Peter Goldmark, echoed that sentiment, saying land management dollars at all levels of government are lacking.
We haven't been successful as of yet in persuading the federal government to really match on a dollar per acre what we've been able to do, which is not enough, quite frankly. They're struggling with their own budget.
Which is exactly why Jack Schubert at the cafe says he's against selling federal land, especially to states.
Absolutely none.
Why not?
They'd sell it up as soon as they had to balance their budget whenever they needed the money. That's why. That's the way state does things.
It remains unclear where desperately needed funding to improve forest health and access might come from. But in his interview with Peterson's Hunting magazine, President-elect Trump seemed keen to leave his mark.
And we're going to be good stewards for the land.
For Here and Now, I'm Emily Schwing.
It's Here and Now, and we want to tell you now about a life that has sadly ended. But in order to do that, we have to go back to how that life was lived, starting in the 1980s.
Hello, I'm Dushan Angus. I'm president of the Rotary Club of Los Alamos, California. My Rotary nickname is Dude.
Dude Angus was a towering figure, and not just because of his height. He was the narrator of a documentary I was lucky enough to make about what happened in 1989 after Steve Angus, the favorite of five beloved children of Dude and Barbara Angus, came home from New York to Los Altos, California, to tell his family he had AIDS and he'd been living with this terrible secret for months.
How are you doing?
Not good, Dad.
Not good?
This is something I can't even... I'm thinking about calling a hospital.
Okay.
Please.
Okay, hon.
You feel like shaking everybody in the store and saying, don't you know what's going on? Don't you know? You know, this could touch your life.
Barbara Angus began visiting other AIDS patients, dying alone in hospital rooms, furious at the comfortable indifference around her.
I mean, somebody scream with me is what I wanted to say. You know, you just feel like you've had it. This isn't a very good day. I'm sorry.
Dude wanted to get the word out, but Steve's siblings were wary. They didn't want their brother to become a statistic. Dude and Steve's sister, Tony, went to a support group.
Everybody there was saying, playing it down that, Yeah. When I was speaking about my brother, Steve, who is the focal point of our family. Sorry.
The statement she gave, though, was, you don't understand. No one else is like my brother.
Steve would die shortly after. Dude had this crazy idea to make a little film that could educate all Rotarians around the world about AIDS. Now, this was at a time when America's leaders wouldn't even say the word. People hid their dying family members in back bedrooms. Dude formed the Los Altos Rotary AIDS Task Force with 10 brave souls, and we began filming.
I'd like to tell you a story. The topic is AIDS. Believe me, a year ago, it was my feeling that that happened to someone else, some other place. Believe me, times have changed.
Some members of his club muttered that AIDS had nothing to do with them. But then Walter Singer, a beloved member who'd survived the Holocaust and played Santa Claus in the annual parade, confided in Dude that he had contracted AIDS through a blood transfusion. And then Dude stood with him, rubbing his back, as he told the stunned club.
So I thought I'd like to share that with you and let you know that I've been walking around with this. I've been asked to join support groups, which we haven't done, because they're mostly young people. I don't know what my outlook is. One of the reasons I sold our business was because I'm sick. I have great support from my wife. And the thing I like to ask my fellow Otarians here, maybe you like to be my support group. Thank you.
Weeping Rotarians surrounded Walter and supported him through his death. Then they fanned out across the country, distributing thousands of copies of the subsequent film, The Los Altos Story. But remember, Dude wanted to reach all Rotarians. So in 1992, he was invited to speak before 19,000 of them at the 83rd Annual International Convention in Orlando, Florida.
I this morning, something I never dreamed would be possible. But I also feel remorse, embarrassment, and guilt that it took the tragic loss of my son to finally get involved. I implore you.
As Dude nervously spoke, Barbara and I sat in the front row bracing for what we thought would be a torrent of boos.
The solution to this problem. Will you look beyond yourself? Will you help us? Thank you so very much.
Instead, a rolling standing ovation. Dude was soon appointed to the first ever Presidential Advisory Council on AIDS under Bill Clinton. One day I got a phone call from director Jonathan Demme. He brought Dude and Barbara to the set of Philadelphia, starring Tom Hanks as an AIDS patient. Joanne Woodward based her character, his mother, on Barbara.
Well, I didn't raise my kids to sit in the back of the bus. You get in there and you fight for your rights, okay?
Gee, I love you guys.
Hi there.
How are you?
Hey, dude. Great. How are you?
Last year, friends, family, and the original members of the Rotary AIDS Task Force gathered around Barbara and Dude, then 81, in failing health and in a wheelchair, for a luncheon.
How are you feeling about today?
I think I'm emotional.
A lot of memories.
A lot. I'm choking.
A sold-out crowd waited inside, there to celebrate the 25th anniversary of Dude's achievement and the film The Los Altos Story. Mary Prochnow, the first to volunteer to help Dude, remembered the overwhelming response to the film.
I remember a young man from upstate New York calling me and telling me that he had let the film sit on his desk for 6 months. He put it in his VCR one evening and wept because his brother was home in his parents' back bedroom. They had told no one in the town. He took the film home. They all wept. He asked his parents' permission to show the film at his own Rotary Club and to tell them that his brother was home dying, and he did that. Our club members will tell you that they go anywhere in the world, and anywhere they go, if they say they're from Los Altos Rotary, the Rotarians applaud them. Dude Angus is a man of amazing drive, and that drive kicked forth an amount of energy that I've rarely seen equaled.
Good afternoon, Los Altos Rotary. Join me in the Pledge of Allegiance. I pledge of allegiance.
This was no ordinary Rotary lunch. The lengthy program included many original members of the AIDS Project Task Force.
I have a lot of memories from this thing. I remember a Rotarian who said, I haven't talked to my son in 2 years. I saw your video. He's here for Thanksgiving.
We also heard from Greg Betts. 25 years ago, when Greg told members of his neighboring Rotary Club that he had AIDS, one member said, you brought it on yourself. I hope you die. Then Dude and the Los Altos AIDS Task Force welcomed him in. He's now living a full life with AIDS.
I want to thank you all for this amazing gift to our community and to all those people that are affected by this disease. Thank you.
After the lunch, well-wishers crowding around Dude and Barbara included Mel Kahn, Dude's former student who became a fellow Rotarian and then was Duded, as they call it, enlisted to speak about AIDS awareness.
Knowing you and your family, you're the one, I've so been Duded, it's because of that energy, and I go up in front of groups that I don't like talking in front of, but I do, because I know that something really spiritual happened. It's more than all of us combined. So we just keep doing it, and I want to thank you for that.
You are so neat. Thank you.
Appreciate
Alan.
It, dude.
Thank you very much.
Well, he's my hero. Knew him as a freshman at Los Altos High School. In those days, he coached everything.
Are you at all surprised that he then became the fuel behind this AIDS project?
No, because he always, when he decides to do something, he does it. In fact, it's pretty cool to it's pretty cool to be friends with your hero. I'm done.
Bye, sweetheart. I'll come up and see you guys.
Okay. As the crowds thinned, we sat down to reflect with Dude and Barbara Angus.
For a long time, I couldn't see the sense of this because of the loss. It was a cleansing experience, knowing that what had been done was affecting so many people positively.
Making maybe your son's loss at least mean something, at least.
That's right. Hoping.
So, 25 years. How are you feeling about that? 25 years.
I have a lot of memories. Most of them good, not so good, some of them, when death is involved over this insidious disease. But we made such great inroads, corporate America, internationally. Oh, God, I feel good about that. And the thing is, we always have new blood coming in. The old hands are still around. God, we overcame almost anything got in our way.
Think how far in 25 years acceptance and compassion has come. Do you think about that, and do you think about your role in that?
We take ownership in the movement, at least partially. We felt we were one of many.
Amazing. The whole world, actually, has changed because of what he did.
Dude and Barbara Angus last year. Dude died this week at 81. For more on the film The Los Altos Story and the Rotary AIDS Task Force work today in Africa, go to herenow.org. And while there, if Dude and his work impacted your life as a Rotarian or a family with AIDS, leave a comment. We'll get it to the family. It's Here and Now.
This podcast and the following message are sponsored by Poo-Pourri, the original before-you-go toilet spray that uses essential oils to trap bathroom odor beneath the surface of the water. Use it next time you have to go at work or when visiting family and friends. Poo-Pourri allows you to go anywhere with uplifting, natural fragrances like lemongrass, lavender, or hibiscus. Whether at work, on a date, even at a party, you can go. Use the code NOW and get 20% off your next purchase at poopourri.com.
The 2017 World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland is underway, and today China's Xi Jinping spoke there in favor of free trade and globalization, saying, quote, "No one will emerge as a winner in a trade war." The conference comes at a time when populism is on the rise in both the U.S. with the election of Donald Trump and in Europe with the Brexit vote. And joining us now for more from Davos is Tom Keane of Bloomberg Surveillance. Welcome back.
Wonderful to be back with you. It's been a year on. It's snowier here and a little bit colder than last year.
And the hot chocolate's still just as good.
Just as good. The coffee, even better. You don't want to leave because of the coffee.
Okay. So tell us more about what President Xi had to say today. This is the first time that a Chinese president has been there and speaking at Davos.
Well, it was very delicate. It was clearly a rehearsed, prepared speech, but it was in the context of what we see with President-elect Trump in Washington and, frankly, the turmoil in Europe, where he basically staked out not a zero-sum game, but a very much-sum game that global trade is good.
We were talking yesterday about the fact that this year, with all that's happened with Donald Trump, with Brexit, that maybe people at Davos who are usually very pro-free trade and globalization are going to have to moderate it a little bit because public opinion in important places is not with them.
Richard Edelman of Edelman PR does an annual visit called the Edelman Trust Barometer. And it's never been more distrustful. It is shocking, the shift in the last 12 months. And as any number of individuals have said today, how do big corporations, how do government officials address immediately the distrust, not to fix it immediately, but just to begin the process? It's not the number one topic here, but it's right up there.
What's the number one topic?
Number one topic, without question right now, is uncertainty. I was prepared for that, Jeremy. We do this every day on Bloomberg Surveillance. I completely underestimated what I heard in people's voices the moment we got up Happy Valley. The flavor and the character of the uncertainties are remarkable.
People just don't know what to expect from Trump, or are you talking about something more broadly?
Everything broadly. The financial markets, the market pros looking at pound sterling or dollar renminbi, the recent collapse of the Mexican peso, those of course looking to Washington. But even at a more core level of economic growth, just is the little bit of rebound that we've seen in the economy, do you believe in it? And that's a very divided opinion right now.
Hmm. Tom Keene, as you walk around Davos today, who do you see? What kind of people are there?
That's a nuanced question. This is my 13th year at Davos. It has changed. There's no question about that. There are more CEOs taking 30 meetings a day, 20 meetings a day, than there were 10 years ago. This is not much different from a plumber's or a music or the last radio convention you went to, Jeremy. Hmm. There's a lot of people taking a lot of meetings away from the imagery and the cynicism and the critics of Davos. There are selective government leaders, but they're not nearly as visible as they used to be. The one thing that's changed, Jeremy, is 8, 9, 10 years ago, a leader would go through with his entourage. That's gone.
That's Tom Keene of Bloomberg Surveillance joining us from Davos, Switzerland. Tom, great to have you as always. Thanks.
Wonderful to be with you.
In Germany, Facebook will soon test a fake news filtering tool, prompted in part by a proposed German law that would fine up to $500 or more for every piece of misinformation posted and not removed by Facebook within 24 hours. In the U.S., there's, of course, been alarm about fake news, not just teenagers in foreign countries making money off fake news sites, but Russia spreading fake news through paid trolls and botnets, portraying Hillary Clinton as a criminal hiding potentially fatal health problems, an example of from the Washington Post. And now U.S. news organizations and Facebook have brought in the fact-checking website Snopes.com. Snopes has long debunked urban legends, but now it's hired extra researchers and amped up its news-checking services. Brooke Binkowski is managing editor at Snopes. Brooke, what's your sense of fake news?
I think that fake news is kind of a misnomer. I think what we should start calling it now to separate it out from the sort of satirical stuff that we've seen for years is propaganda, because what we're looking at is really propaganda from outside the United States and from within the United States. Whether or not it's intended ideologically or if it's just something that people are doing for fun or for some extra cash, it's politicized. It's meant to evoke some kind of emotional response and reaction and get people to think a certain way.
Well, you've got, for instance, James Dowd. This is the Brit who runs something called Patriot News. He was for the Brexit, fought for that. He's a fan of Putin. He's spoken in Russia. He's linked to Russian Facebook. And according to the New York Times, he pumped out pro-Trump stories about Hillary Clinton's ties to Satanism and pedophilia and says that is his mission, to get those kinds of stories into America so that Trump could win.
There's that kind of ideological news that, or I can't even call it news because a lot of it is so fake. They mix a little truth in it to make it believable, and then the rest of it is just meant to make you angry generally, or upset you in some way, or make you afraid. And that's really dangerous, especially when it's almost impossible to tell it apart from real news when you're looking at the way the website's set up and things like that. There are people, of course, a lot of people on the left and the right who say, well, it doesn't matter. My point stands. It doesn't matter if it's actually true. I've actually heard this argument a lot. And I think that that comes from this sort of extra polarized environment, plus a healthy dollop of identity politics, wherein you end up with the situation where how you feel is more important than the actual fact.
Give us some examples.
Look at how tenacious the birther myth has been, that President Obama was not born in Kenya. The fact that there is no proof that he was born anywhere but where he says he was. has not deterred any of the entrenched birther types. There's this one particularly tenacious myth, almost as tenacious as the birther one, which was that Hillary Clinton, when she was a young lawyer, defended a child rapist and then laughed about it later when she was talking to an interviewer about it. If you listen to the actual recording, she says something to the effect of, "That was how I learned that lie detector tests aren't always accurate." And she laughs in this sort of this ironic kind of bitter lesson learned kind of way. And then that was used as a way to inform people of the other extremely tenacious new one, which was, of course, Pizzagate, where Hillary Clinton is apparently complicit in running a child sex trafficking ring out of a pizza parlor in Washington, D.C.
Well, in that one, a man believed it so much that he took up a gun and drove to the pizza parlor to try to liberate the non-existent child sex slaves. Look, those are clear. And let's explain how Snopes works for those who haven't gone online. You have tons of researchers. You lay things out in a very direct way, and you say whether something is true or false or maybe muddied, you know, whether you don't have a true or false conclusion. It's very easy to debunk a child sex slave ring in the basement of a pizza place. But how else do you do research when there are so many opinions about so many different things? How do you get at the truth of something?
Well, we do just old-fashioned reporting, talking to people in the community and pulling public records, pulling together data. We do a lot of stuff by phone. There's a lot of online research we can do with all the online databases, but there's no magic bullet. It's just reporting.
Well, but how hard has it gotten, given that, you know, when Snopes first started, you were doing things like, you know, whether or not there's alligators in manholes, you know, urban myths. But now you have people who reject anything that doesn't fit their own sense of what true is.
Their own narrative, yeah. We've gotten into this sort of like post-postmodernism that's like there's no actual truth or reality. But it hasn't become any harder to debunk anything. It's just that there's so much more right now. It comes from the extreme left. It comes from the extreme right. You've got the chemtrail people. You've got the anti-vaxxers. You've got the Russia responsible for anything that's going wrong. You've got the Russia is our ally and they would never do anything. Everything is extremely confusing at the moment for most people.
Well, you talk about the recent memos that the intelligence agencies were said to have discussed with Donald Trump and Barack Obama that indicated that Russia not only colluded with the Trump campaign, but that the Russians might have salacious information on Donald Trump that could make him blackmailable. As you say, these are completely unverified reports. You also do things like come down the middle on something and let the readers decide. And I'm looking at your article that's really trending now about Donald Trump criticized for mocking a disabled reporter. First of all, you have side-by-side pictures of that reporter, Serge Kovalsky, with an arm twisted by a syndrome that he has, and a picture of Donald Trump appearing to mock that exact disability. You have Serge saying he was on a first-name basis with Donald Trump, interviewed him 15 or so times, next to Donald Trump saying, "I've never met him, I don't know who he is." And you let the readers decide.
We couldn't really make a judgment call one way or the other because he has sort of the advantage of plausible deniability, Trump does. He said that he just was waving his arms around as he talked. But if you watch the video, which we have on the site, you can kind of decide for yourself. One of the things that we tried to do is not get into anybody's head. So we just kind of put it out side by side, lay everything out for the reader to decide for themselves.
What are some of the websites, and they're on the right and the left, but what are some of the websites or the news sources that you know are going to have some falsehoods?
So AssociatedMediaCoverage.com has been one that doesn't seem to print anything factual, but it's always very timely. And then there's another one called politicallow.com. So it's political and then an O. Basically, it's one paragraph is true, and then the second paragraph is not true. And then you have to figure out for yourself what's true after that. And there's newslow.com. And basically, they call themselves satire, but if you don't know any better, you are basically taken in by this. And then there's the sites that have gone just completely partisan one way or the other. Natural News is another repeat offender. Breitbart, of course. And the redlineofdefense.org. They don't publish anything factual. It's all satire. But they end up creating a stir because they seem to be really good at figuring out what's going to make people angry and upset.
Well, you mentioned Breitbart, which of course was run until recently by the now top advisor to Donald Trump. And they've been accused of everything from editing a Missouri professor's words in the classroom to make it appear like they're backing violence in the labor rights movement to saying that Planned Parenthood had its roots in Nazism. What is your sense of Breitbart?
I don't think of them as fake news at all, but I do think that they have a definite slant and they have a definite outcome in mind. It seems that they are becoming more and more protectionist and nationalistic, and their stories reflect that.
And you're sort of on the receiving end of somebody who's worked quite a bit for Breitbart accusing you of printing something false about him.
So there was a guy who is accused of planning to infiltrate the Women's March on Washington the day after the inauguration and start rabble-rousing and do, you know, provocateur stuff. And so this rumor's been going around Facebook. So we looked into it and tried to debunk it. We pasted the Facebook message, and it says, the guy is James O'Keefe, and it says that James O'Keefe is a domestic terrorist. And we quoted this in order to debunk it. That's kind of our standard. He did a screenshot of that part where it says he's a domestic terrorist and said that we were calling him a domestic terrorist. And that was annoying. But what was more annoying is that people couldn't be bothered to go to the website itself and look at the actual article. And that's the kind of thing we have been up against quite a lot lately.
Brooke Binkowski, managing editor at Snopes.com, speaking to us from San Diego. Brooke, we'll link people up. Thanks so much.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Samsung is facing a major crisis, its second in the last few months. Tomorrow, a court will decide whether to grant prosecutors' request to arrest J.Y. Lee, the South Korean smartphone maker's de facto chief. There are allegations of bribery, embezzlement, and perjury, and it's all tied to the now-impeached South Korean president, Park Geun-hye. And if you've been on an airplane recently, you know about Samsung's other problem, the Galaxy Note 7, which kept catching on fire and is now recalled and in many cases banned from the skies. Here with more is our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. Ina Fried is senior editor of mobile for Recode. She joins us from San Francisco. Hi, Ina.
Hi, Jeremy.
And let's talk first about this scandal with the head of Samsung, the de facto chief, J.Y. Lee. What are the allegations here?
So this relates, as you mentioned in the opening, to a scandal involving the Korean president, Park Geun-hye. And the issue here is whether Samsung CEO, like other CEOs, as the allegations go, donated money to a foundation that was tied to the president in exchange for political favors, better treatment of the business. So it's tied to that. You know, it's not actually as uncommon as you would think for Korean tribal or conglomerate CEOs to not only get arrested, but even run their companies from jail.
And among Americans, J.Y. Lee is not somebody who's well known the way that the CEOs of Apple or Google or other big companies are. But how important is this guy? What has he done at Samsung?
Well, you know, his father was the CEO before him and has been in ailing health for a long time. I mean, I think he's important in the sense that, you know, like American CEOs, he makes key strategic decisions, especially around, you know, where is the company going to put his resources? This isn't the person running Samsung day to day. Samsung has tons of different divisions. They make everything from washing machines to smartphones to all kinds of things. And each of those businesses runs pretty independently. But he's pretty important from a strategic point of view. And certainly, if anything, it's a huge succession crisis for Samsung if something happens to him legally.
And meanwhile, as we said, Samsung is also dealing with the issues with the Galaxy Note 7. People may be surprised to hear it is the largest smartphone maker in the world. It's not Apple, it's Samsung. And the Galaxy Note 7 was recalled after reports it was catching on fire. Do we know, first of all, the cause at this point of what was going on with the Galaxy Note 7?
We don't yet, although Samsung said at CES to expect its report that it compiled both on its own and with some outside investigators very soon. Reuters is saying it'll happen on January 23rd, the day before the company reports its earnings. So I think we'll be hearing a lot more about this soon.
And meanwhile, Samsung is still making phones with the name Galaxy, right?
They are. And I mean, the Galaxy Note is off the market and the Galaxy S7 is still probably the best selling phone in the world. Certainly the most, you know, at the high end of the market, you know, right up there with Apple's iPhone. I think the idea that Samsung has been really hurt in the short term isn't true. I mean, they've really kept plugging. Most of the people who returned their Note 7s bought a Galaxy S7. And in a lot of ways, Samsung has kept on going despite this issue.
At the same time, you would think that would be a difficult thing to work through, the fact that every time you get on an airplane now, they say, if you've got a Galaxy Note 7, it's got to be turned completely off or tell us about it, and you can't fly with it turned on.
Yeah, I mean, it's been hundreds of millions of dollars of negative advertising that they've gotten at this. So I think it is, you know, I think the real test is going to be when the Galaxy S8 comes out in a little bit. That usually comes out in the beginning of the year. I think, you know, how do they, you know, make sure that buyers that aren't tied to Samsung go out and buy it? I think that's going to be much more difficult, a bigger task than it was to get people to trade in their Note for another Samsung product. They were able to provide financial incentives for that. And, you know, these were loyal Samsung buyers. I think, can they get the next, you know, when those people are, you know, starting fresh, do they get them? And does another Android phone maker step up into that place and really challenge Samsung?
How is Samsung doing overall in smartphone sales compared to Apple?
Well, it's doing really well. I mean, Samsung is bigger in units for sure than Apple. Apple makes more profit on its phones, especially per phone, than Samsung. But Samsung is bigger. They cover more of the market. So in addition to the flagship Galaxy and Galaxy Note phones, they have a range of phones, you know, all the way down to the kind of phones, you know, you get for free with a prepaid phone or what have you. So they're doing really well. And they, you know, the markets they're struggling aren't the Note 7 areas. It's really the kind of things like the really competitive Chinese market where you have a lot of people competing for that mid-range smartphone. They're doing really well in the high end, despite what would seem to be a really big blow with the Note 7.
That's Ina Fried, senior editor of mobile for Recode, talking with us about Samsung and its pros and cons right now. Ina, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.